Greetings and welcome to the acquisition of IAS conference call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question and answer session. At that time, if you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. Should you require operator assistance at any time, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded today, Wednesday, December 4th, 2019. I would now like to turn the conference over to Marie-Annick Bonneau, Head of Investor Relations. Please go ahead.
Good evening and welcome to this conference call. Background information for the call, including the news release and the slides for this conference call, are posted in the Investor Relations section of our website at ia.ca. The conference call is open to the financial community, the media, and the public. The call will begin with prepared remarks, followed by a question period, which is reserved for financial analysts. A recording of this call will be available for 1 week starting this evening. The archive webcast will be available for 90 days, and a transcript will be available shortly on our website. I also want to draw your attention to the word about forward-looking statements at the beginning of the slide package and to the disclaimer regarding non-IFRS measures, which is at the end of same presentation. I will now turn the call over to our President and CEO, Denis Ricard.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this call. We know it's a very busy period for you and a little late in the day, so we really appreciate your presence. Today, we are thrilled to announce our agreement to acquire IAS, one of the largest independent solutions provider in the U.S. vehicle warranty market. IAS is a large national player, offers a full suite of vehicle warranties, and works off a multiple-channel distribution platform. Located in Austin, Texas, it has about 600 employees, and sold more than 1.6 million coverages last year. Like IA, it is a growth-oriented organization that has grown significantly over the last few years, both organically and through acquisitions. In line with our vision for IA, this acquisition will give us a bigger footprint in the U.S. and a leading presence in the U.S. vehicle warranty market. This new scale will position us to actively participate in the consolidation of the very fragmented vehicle warranty market. IA has a history of being disciplined when developing new markets and making acquisitions. This one is no different. IA took its first steps in dealer services in 1999 following the purchase of Seaboard Life that was in the business since 1962. We steadily grew the business in Canada while developing our expertise over the last two decades. In 2018, under the leadership of Mike Stickney, we purchased DAC and expanded our vehicle warranty operations in the U.S. market. As a former executive of Seaboard Life and of IA's Dealer Services Division in Canada, and as the head of our U.S. operations since 2005, Mike Stickney has a deep understanding of both the vehicle warranty business and the U.S. market. Mike successfully integrated DAC, which resulted in double-digit growth for both top and bottom lines. DAC's strong momentum confirms the growth potential of the U.S. vehicle market and that we have the know-how to thrive in that segment. Over the last few quarters, I often mentioned that we had a lot of excess capital generated organically and through investment strategies. We are now pleased to put this capital to work by acquiring IAS, a leading company in a market that we like. Due to our current capital position, this acquisition will be paid in cash and be accretive in 2021. IAS is an excellent fit to pursue our growth strategy in the U.S. Not only does it meet our financial criteria, it is also complementary to our DAC operations. Slide 9 provides some metrics on both IAS and DAC, while slide 10 and 11 show the complementarity of products as well as the important synergies between the two companies. The combined strengths of DAC and IAS will result in full vertical integration and a center of excellence to support our expanding U.S. operations. When looking at acquisition, we pay a lot of attention to culture and quality of management. IAS fully meets these criteria, as it is led by a strong and high-performing management team who shares our entrepreneurial and growth-oriented culture. I look forward to welcoming our new colleagues and working with them to further build on our leading presence in the U.S. vehicle warranty market. On that note, I'll now pass it over to our CFO, Jacques Potvin, who will cover the key financial benefits of the transaction.
Thanks, Denis, and good evening, everyone. Today is a very exciting day for IA as we become a North American leader in the vehicle warranty market. As mentioned by Denis, IAS and DAC are complementary in many respects, which creates opportunities on the top line, but also for synergies and cost efficiencies. These include, among other, reductions in system redundancies and optimization of operations. Moving to slide 12, the vehicle warranty business is a market of nearly $40 billion in the U.S. It is a great industry to be in, a big pie in which we are happy to take a big bite. The industry's strong growth is driven by many factors in the automotive industry that are favorable to the expansion of the vehicle warranty market. Moreover, this market has demonstrated that it is resilient in the context of economic downturns, as profit from warranties becomes a more important proportion of dealers' total profit as consumers look to extend the life of their car. Another item of note is that the vehicle warranty business in the U.S. is mostly a fee business, which we view as low risk. Now, refer to slide 13, where you have an overview of the financial aspect of the transaction. The purchase price of $720 million will be paid from excess capital upon closing of the transaction. Closing of the transaction is subject to usual regulatory approvals, and we expect that it will occur during the first half of 2020. Probably in March or April. The solvency ratio is 117% pro forma September 30, 2019, which is above our target range of 110-116%. Taking into consideration our capacity to generate organic capital and the stability of our capital, this is an appropriate capital position for IA, one that we are very comfortable with. Another positive aspect of this transaction is its contribution to EPS. We expect that the impact on EPS will be neutral during the first year. However, beginning in the second year will be accretive. We anticipate that EPS accretion in 2021 will be about 17 cents and 38 cents for 2022. Like other acquisitions in the past, IAS and our U.S. extended warranty business will become an important contributor to our annual EPS growth of 10% plus.
So, in conclusion, we are very proud to announce the acquisition of IAS today. By bringing together DAC and IAS, we will become a best-in-class provider of vehicle warranty products and services. This acquisition will create significant value for our shareholders and will be a catalyst for U.S. expansion. Operator, we will now take questions.
Thank you very much, sir. If you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your request has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. Once again, all, to register a question, it is the 1-4 on your telephone keypad. Our first question comes from the line of Meny Grauman with Cormac Securities. Your line is open.
Hi, good evening. Just a few questions. One, how competitive was the process? Were you competing against private equity specifically?
Hi, it's Denny here. Yes, there was an auction on this case. In fact, if I look at the landscape of market in the U.S., over the last several months, we participated in a couple of auction like that, and we are very disciplined in the way we look at it. So in some cases we drew from the process, but in this particular process there were several players, and basically when you are in the U.S. market for that kind of business, you have to pay somewhere between 10 and 12 times EBITDA. So in some situation in the past, we've not been able to go to step two or step three, but in this particular case, I think that the fact that we were like a kind of a preferred buyer for the other party, and at the same time we had a competitive price, made a good fit, I would say, with the other party. The other thing I would like to add is that whenever we looked at a company in the U.S. in particular, We take great care to make sure that the management that we inherit, I would say, from these acquisitions are very, very, I would say, at the top of the skill set. And we were very, very pleased with the quality of the management of the company that we ended up with.
And can I just ask about synergies? I mean, you touched on some cost synergies like system redundancies, but I'm wondering, in terms of the 17 cents that you referred to and then the 30 cents, is that how much of that is cost synergies and how much of that is revenue synergies? And if you could expand a little bit on the revenue synergies side of things.
Yeah, there are cost synergies, there are revenue synergies. As an example, IAS was using reinsurance company for their in their process. And I'll use an example here. They used DAC was one of them. That was quite funny. DAC was one of them, but they used it only 16% of their business. So here you see some kind of revenue synergy over time, certainly. And what you have to keep in mind is that the fact that we have 17 and 38 cents, it includes the fact that we have synergy. So over time, you should expect an increasing pattern of EPS accretiveness because of the way this business, is being bought.
And in terms of the expected synergies, at what point do you expect to get sort of a steady state, at least in terms of the cost synergies? How long will that take to fully realize?
I would say about 2 years.
Okay. Thank you.
And our next question comes from the line of Gabriel Deschaine with National Bank Financial. Your line is open.
Good morning, or afternoon, sorry. I have a couple numbers questions and then a strategic one. So just rough estimate here based on those accretion numbers, that's what, a $30 million earnings impact in 2021 and moving to 50 or so in 2021? That's, I think, gross earnings of the operation.
Could you repeat, Gabriel, please?
Yeah, so I'm looking at the 17 cents and the 38 cents that you gave, and then I'm factoring in the foregone earnings on excess capital, trying to figure out what the gross earnings of this IES business is, and I'm getting to around $50 million on a pro forma basis.
Gabriel, I will take that one off the call because I don't have those numbers with me. I don't want to give you a bad information.
Okay, so what's the earnings generation? You gave EBITDA, it's $60 million U.S. What's the earnings generation of IAS?
Yeah, it's Denis here. I think when you look at the accretiveness, it's all included. So basically, it's the impact. You can guess, for example, that the excess capital was earning a return after tax of something like between 2 and 2.5%. So you can factor
okay.
in.
Okay.
So we're giving you the net of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So that's very helpful, actually. The LICAT change. Is that primarily goodwill and then a bit of insurance risk increase? Like, could you help me? I'm just guessing $900 million of reduction in available capital and maybe $100 or so million of increase in insurance risk. Is that in the ballpark?
Yeah, actually, Gabriel, is $1 billion, a little bit more than $1 billion of goodwill and intangible, and close to $90 million of insurance risk.
Okay. You mentioned scale benefits or synergies anyway. And I'm just looking at the numbers you provided. I see DAC, EBITDA, to premiums written of 3%, whereas IES is 11%. So, is that indicative of the amount of expense synergies you can extract here?
It's more, I would say, the profile of the business. So IAS is, when you look, for example, at the profile of their business, they sell much more, let's say, ancillary type of warranty. Those are like higher margin type of warranties. So when you look for the ratio of the EBITDA of each, you see that that IAS is much more profitable per, let's say, per $100 of premium. But it's a reflection of the profile of the business.
Okay, and speaking of profile, it's not a business that I don't think most people fully understand yet, so there's going to be some educationating on that, but how about this very simple question? How do you lose money in this business? You said it's mostly fee-based, it's low risk. Let me understand, what's kind of the worst-case scenario for this extended auto warranty business?
Okay, well, we'll give a crack at it, Gabriel. We keep the underwriting risk for 10% of the business, okay? And this is a great profitable business. And for 90% of the business, the dealer take the underwriting risk so that our business model is really the admin fee for managing the operation. So it's really fee income for most of the business.
So the dealer would have to go out of business for you to actually take a loss on the reinsurance side?
Yeah, actually, the dealer set a reinsurance company. However, that's quite important that to consider that we administer the money, okay? So we handle the cash, and what we do, we send that cash into a trust that is regulated by NAIC. National Association of Insurance Commissioner.
Yeah.
So we are very well protected because when we provide the cash to the dealer, it's after all the claims have been paid.
Okay, well, thanks for that. If my note is short tomorrow, it's because I got to wake up at 5 a.m. But have a good Christmas if we don't talk before then.
Thank you. We understand.
Our next question comes from the line of Doug Young with Desjardins Capital. Your line is open.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the numbers side. And what I'm trying to get a sense of is how would this not be accretive in year one? And if I do the math as Gabriel went through, the earnings contribution for year one is, I call it, $15 to $20 million. And if it's, neutral to EPS, it means it's equivalent to the earnings that you're giving up. How do you get there from $60 million of EBITDA down to that 20 or 50 to 20 is on a Canadian dollar basis, so it would be even lower on U.S. dollars. But how do you get from $60 million of EBITDA down to that level of earnings?
You have to factor in integration costs. You have to factor in intangible amortization.
Yeah, in the first year, the integration expenses, we've put that into the I mean, you, accounting-wise, you have to account for that in the first year. So that's the main reason.
And so, Denny, what is the amount, the integration cost that you're building in? And is that something you're going to be highlighting as an item of note? Or and then the amortization of intangibles, because I would imagine that's going to continue on. Can you give those two numbers?
Actually, we will have to finalize the purchase price allocation within 12 months from now on. So the about the expense, we will show it as an item of notes.
So if we back out the integration cost, this would be accretive in year one? Is that fair to assume?
Even including it, it's when we say neutral, it's close to that. So for sure, by removing that, it is accretive.
And you don't have a sense of what that, okay, the integration cost would be. So that's first. So the second is the earnout. How have you structured the earnout, if there is an earnout, and lockup? Because you've talked extensively about the quality of management. How have you locked up the team that you're buying?
We've designed a kind of an RSU program during a period of 5 years.
And that's for the earnout and for and how is that cliff vest? Is that how it works?
Sorry, is that what?
Does it not get paid out until the end of the 5 years is up? Is that so? There's a 5 year lock-in.
It's gradual. I mean, the vesting is gradual. It's like a, you know, kind of a regular RSU, but on the performance of IAS and DAC.
And how many people are involved in that?
The key person in the organization.
Oh, just one key person?
Key persons.
Oh, key persons.
Key people.
Okay.
Yeah.
Key people. Okay. And then just what? So after you've done this transaction, like what would be your market share in the vehicle warranty market?
So you have to know that the market is around $40 billion total. And so if you look on slide 9, you see that the premium, let's say 2019, would be close to $1 billion. So that means if you do the math, it's about 2.5%. So even at 2.5%, we are, I would call it a big player, because when you look at that market, it's very fragmented, and the number one player does not even have 10%, or is close to 10%.
And then just lastly, it sounds like IAS didn't do as much reinsurance, but your strategy will be to do like you do with DAC and essentially reinsure 90% of that back to the dealer market. Is that how you're going to be structuring this?
Well, actually, they are using reinsurance. It's just that they were not using DAC. They were using several players. That's what I said before.
Okay.
So they are using. I mean, the dealer. Actually, it's the dealer who wants to use reinsurance because he wants to participate in the underwriting profit.
Yeah. So the structure, the way you're going to be running this, after you've assumed IAS, is going to be similar to the way that you're currently structured. With the use of reinsurance.
That's a fair comment.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much.
Our next question comes from the line of Darko Mihelic with RBC Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Thank you. My first question is, I'd like to know a little bit more about IAS and how it grew. It sounds like it grew via acquisition. So maybe if you can give just a brief overview of how IAS became as big as it did, and how recently was it involved in acquisitions?
So, that's a good question. It's been around for 35 years plus, but in fact, there was a key point in time when the current team got into the business, which was 3 or 4 years ago, and at that point, the new management changed a lot of things. They entered at about the same time the VSC market. They were mostly in the ancillary warranty before. And they started to, create a M&A process, like a programmatic acquisition strategy at that time. So they did 10 over the last 5 years. And actually, I mean, right now, in terms of the result, it's not something that is like that. I mean, I don't like to say that, but because it can be important, but it's not something that moves the needle, I mean, in a major way, okay? It adds to the growth, it's important, and it's in the strategy going forward. The idea is to consolidate the market, whether it's on the agent side or also some TPAs or also some special companies. Like they bought a company, in fact, they bought a company at the start of this year that is really like a technology company that allows dealers to be much more efficient in the data mining. So we're not only buying, let's say, the traditional business that we have for DAC, we're also buying additional capabilities in the technology world so that the dealer is much more, I would say, productive in identifying opportunities within their book. So it's all different type of, I would say, companies that has been bought over time, but the idea is to be more efficient on one side, but also to consolidate on the agent side.
Okay, and so a follow-up to that is under the IA umbrella, presumably this will continue, but these are small deals. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah, those are small deals. An average, you know, average EBITDA, you know, for would be, I don't know, between 1 and 5 million for each of these acquisitions. So those would be tuck-in acquisition. You know, over time, as the number increases, you know, it makes a difference. But each of them individually don't really make a difference, unless it's to get into a new market or a new capabilities, like was done, you know, at the beginning of this year.
So I guess where I was going with this is that the reason why they decided to sell themselves was to get access to capital for larger deals?
It was owned by a private equity fund, so it was time for them to sell. You know, the private equity fund at some point, they want to just sell. Were they constrained in terms of capital? To some extent, yes. But, you know, we would be prepared at some point to do bigger acquisition. Obviously, we'll take the time to really integrate that one. You know, it's a historical big acquisition for IA. So we want to make sure we don't screw up, obviously. So we want to make sure that the execution of the plan that we have is going to be done fine. So that will be the priority. We will continue to do those, let's say, small acquisition, tuck-in acquisition, and eventually we'll look at larger ones to consolidate the market.
Okay. All right, thank you very much.
Our next question comes from the line of Tom McKinnon, BMO Capital.
Yeah, thanks very much. A couple questions. First is, you talk about, I think it's capital generation annually of 250 to 300 million. How does this acquisition change that? Assuming if this is pretty capital light, does that mean your annual capital generation should be higher than that when we look out into 2022?
Yes, Tom, you're right there because, like you said, it's capital light. So for sure that you can add the profit that will come from that acquisition in addition to the 250 to 300.
Okay. Just on IAS, this doesn't – when you bought dealers, you got an insurance company involved in dealers. Do you have an insurance company here, or is this at a – more of an administrator of this business?
Like I mentioned earlier, for 90% of the business, we will do all the administration, and the underwriting risk will be assumed by the dealer through a reinsurance company that he owns. So that's the way the business works. And for the
that's the way IAS is going to work. Is that correct?
That's the way the market, Tom, in the U.S., it works is that the dealer, they set up their reinsurance company, and basically they profit share on 100% of the underwriting risk. And we administer the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. but in IAS, is there an insurance company that retains this 10%? I mean, Dealers has an insurance company that retains some of this business too.
It's the obligor. Yes, they can keep some, and now with DAC, we will certainly use DAC more often instead of other insurer.
Okay, and is that anticipated in your accretion numbers as well? That you're going to be replacing some of their arrangements and putting DAC in there instead?
For sure.
Okay, and then the second question is the 2021, or the third question I should say, 2021 17 cents and then 2022 38 cents. What is it more than double year over year? Hello?
And pardon me all, unfortunately we seem to have lost the main line. It'll take a moment to reconnect. Please stand. And that line is almost ready to rejoin. It'll be a moment. And the line is rejoined. Thank you.
Perfect.
Please proceed with your question.
Oh, yeah. So it's Tom McKinnon. My question about 2021,
cents,
and I think you said 2022 was, I thought you said 38 cents. I'm just trying to figure out why it more than doubles year over year in terms of that accretion.
And unfortunately, there does seem to be a continuing issue with that connection. Please stand by. We'll try to reestablish as quickly as possible. Thank you all for your patience. That line is just about to rejoin. And we have the line reconnected. Thank you.
We're ready for other questions.
Yeah. I was trying to ask a question about 2021. I think you said the accretion was 17 cents. In 2022, the accretion was 38 cents. I'm wondering why does it double year over year, or does that have to do with integration costs?
It has to. You're too smart. It has to do with integration costs.
Are there no integration costs in 2022?
There are some. I should explain myself a little bit better. Actually, a large part of it is integration costs, but there growth as well. But the most of it, when you say it's double, the main explanation is integration costs.
Okay. So we have integration costs in 2020 and in 2021. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And it's 17 cents in 2021 and 38 cents in 2022 in terms of accretion. Okay, that's fine. Thanks.
Tom, if you don't mind, I'd like to add on this. One thing that is important to understand, even after 2022, there is a significant increase in EPS accretiveness that we expect, because over the last 3 years, there's been tremendous growth of the F&I for IAS, 16% growth. And so what's happening is that they're growing very significantly, and each cohort of sales, the profit of that cohort is being recognized over the term of the product. And so it's like we are in a pattern where it's like a stair. You know, each year the new cohort adds to the previous one. So there is an increasing pattern of EPS over time. You should not conclude that after 2 years, because there is no integration cost, that the EPS will only grow by a small amount. I mean, it's increasing significantly also after 2 years.
Okay, thanks for that.
Our next question comes from the line of Paul Holden with CIBC World Markets.
Thank you. Good evening. I'll just limit it to a couple questions, but just a follow-up on that last point, that 16% earnings growth for IAS. What proportion of that would be organic versus acquired?
Well, most of it would be organic. And in fact, I think one message I'd like also to convey to all of you is that since the management has changed, they've really pushed hard on their growth. And so 60%, and when you look at it compared to the industry, when I look at it for the last 5 years, the industry has grown, the F&I market in the U.S. has grown by 9% a year. So they've outgrown the industry. And when you compare it, let's say, to the growth of the new car in the U.S., new car in the U.S. over the same period increased by 1%. So then you can see that, first of all, the F&I penetration in the market has grown significantly compared, because cars have sold by plus 1% a year, and then F&I business by 9%. And IAS has outgrown the market as well.
Okay. I'd like to understand the financial models of DAC versus IAS just a little bit better, because if I look at the premiums written relative to EBITDA, the EBITDA margin relative to premiums, if that's a metric, I'm not sure if it's a good metric, but it's a metric we have, looks a lot higher, the margin looks a lot higher than for IAS than DAC. So just trying to understand why. Like, is that the ancillary services you're talking about, or is it some other feature of their business?
Yeah, there are some, it's a profile. It's the profile of the product, and there are some businesses that have a lower loss ratio. They're more in proportion of DAC, for example. In IAS, sell more in those segments of the market that have a low loss ratio, so a better profitability. That's the main reason.
Okay. And can you transport that or transplant some of that higher margin profile over to the existing DAC business?
Yeah, if you look at it, when you look at the relationship with dealers, I think one thing you need to know is that there are not that many dealers that are with both. Our estimation is that there may be, about 100 dealers. So it's marginal compared to the total. So you're right. We can have some synergies on both sides.
Got it. Okay. And then final question, as I think about those bolt-on acquisitions to come at some point in the future, whether they're large or small, would they involve the same type of integration costs that you expect to experience with IAS, or would there be less integration costs and more immediate EPS accretion?
It's more immediate EPS accretion.
Okay, great. Those are the questions I had. Thank you.
Next question comes from the line of Sumit Malhotra with Scotiabank.
Thanks. Good evening, guys. It sounds like, you know, in hearing the comments on the EPS accretion, it sounds like these numbers have been provided on a reported basis for reported EPS, although IA has obviously used the core measure as its primary communication tool to the market, and I think you have adjusted out some of the acquisition-related costs in the past. So I don't know if you have this handy or not, but when we think about 17 cents in 2021, am I correct that that's the reported EPS pickup? And if so, what do you think it would be on a on your so-called core measure?
You're right, it's on the reported, and I don't have the information for on a core measure, but we will show it as an item of notes about the integration costs.
Okay, but I think you've answered it there. So I think usually we're willing to consider the acquisition costs as an item of note, and so you're going to be the 38 cents is more what you think is representative of the run rate earnings power, earnings pickup after the integration is complete. That's a more accurate way to think about it?
Exactly. And like Denis mentioned, this is an EPS that will grow over time with a big base, huge base.
All right. And just thinking about the balance sheet, obviously, Denis, we've had lots of conversations about the changes that have been enacted under your tenure to free up capital and to generate more on a go-forward basis. You've been communicating with us an excess capital or a deployable proceeds, however you want to put it. I think the last number we had was $1.3 billion. When you give us that number, though, I think it also contemplates potential changes in leverage. Do you plan, or is it your assumption that you will issue some debt to finance this? And I guess more to the point, one way or another, you're allocating about $1 billion Canadian. Is it as simple as saying the $1.3 billion that you reported at Q3 is now roughly $300 million, or is there more to it than that?
Well, just to your first point, what I would say is that we are quite comfortable with the current structure that we have. We don't feel any urgency to issue any type of capital at this point. We are going to, the priority will stay the same, it's growth. So we have like deployment of capital, I mentioned it several times, that acquisition, I mean organic growth is the first one. The second is obviously acquisition. You should expect that we are still looking at some acquisition, you know, more tucking I would say in the short term, but we'll continue to be active. We're very pleased with our current structure of capital. And we are generating, as you know, a lot of capital each year, the equivalent of 4% in terms of solvency ratio, even without the investment strategies. So we are in a very good shape. I mean, remember that the change in LICAT or the solvency ratio regime in 2018 has been a game changer, has been a huge game changer. So we have more flexibility in how to raise capital, and the organic generation is the first, it's the best way to generate capital.
Well, look, I completely agree with that. I just want to make sure I'm thinking about the numbers correctly in terms of your capacity. So sorry to put too fine a point on it, but versus that 1.3 that you talked about last quarter, is it we take $1 billion off that and right now you're at 300 plus whatever you generate going forward? Is that accurate or that's what I just want to try to ascertain here?
Actually, you can submit. You can look also at Q3, use the pro forma we provide, 117 compared to 134%.
Yep.
That will give you a good idea of the capital we're using. Like I said earlier, goodwill intangible at slightly above $1 billion and capital that we need to put debt at $90 million. So those numbers should help you to get to the amount. So, and on a pro forma basis at 117%, and of course, we expect that transaction to close end of Q1 or beginning of Q2 next year, so we'll have time to create, to generate new capital.
All right, guys, I appreciate that. There's a few numbers to work through today, so we'll add this to the list. Thank you for your time.
Next question comes from the line of Mario Mendonca with TD Securities.
Good evening. Can you hear me okay, guys?
We do.
Great. Denis, this first deal was important, I guess, not only because of the financial side, but as you made clear, it was important you get a management team that can take this to the next level. now that you've sort of checked that box, that you're confident you have the right leader for the business, would it be fair to say that on a go-forward basis, transactions will be, and I don't want to suggest that there'll be plenty of them and they'll be easy, but now that you're just dealing with the financial metrics, not the management team, should we expect an increased pace of deals, say in 2020 or 2021?
Well, like I said, Mario, it's funny, it's normal, we are looking forward here, but this is a historical moment for the company. It's a very large acquisition, and you can be sure that our eyes will be towards the U.S. and making sure that the plan that is behind that acquisition will be realized. So, yes, I know that we would like to immediately look at the pace of acquisition in the future, but I would say that in the very short term, my focus would be to make sure that we can execute and realize the synergies and realize the profit that is embedded in this deal. Now, with that said, I think that with time, we'll probably get a lot of comfort with this, and with also the fact that we can raise capital organically. I can visualize, let's say, in a year or 18 months, that we say, okay, we are more comfortable to go at bigger fish than we will be over the next 12 to 18 months. So I guess that's the way I would answer your question.
Okay, and we're all trying to get, and this is probably more appropriate for Jacques, we're all trying to get at the accretion of this deal in the near term on an adjusted basis, because for better or for worse, we've all been trained to focus on the adjusted number, analysts and the street. So maybe, Jacques, let me ask it this way. The integration expenses, what proportion do you expect to expense in 2020 relative to 2021? Is it 75% of the expenses in 2020 and the other 25% in 2021? Is that fair?
Yeah, I don't have those numbers with me, Mario. I can provide some color on it offline, but I don't have that with me today.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Actually, maybe I will make a comment on that one. You know that in Canada, we have to prepare for IFRS 17. Usually a transaction like that, most of the integration costs will be in the first year, maybe some in the second year. But the fact that we're buying a U.S. company and we have to be ready for IFRS 17, so there's more integration costs in the second year for that deal that we used to have in other acquisition. So that's why it's tough for me to give you a metric. I don't have the real number.
So it is fair to say that most of the time, like virtually every transaction that I've seen over the years, virtually all of the expenses are in the year the deal closes. Like you set up the liability and then you incur the expenses later. But it sounds to me like under IFRS 17, you can't build up the liability in year one. Is that essentially what you're saying?
No, actually, it's only us. It's only us. We wanted to make sure to factor in into that acquisition that it will cost us money to make sure that we are able to report our U.S. operation, those IES operation under the IFRS accounting regime.
So we'll have to develop the
system and all do that. So for us, it's really integration costs. And maybe an information I can provide for everyone. In 2023, we forecast that the EPS will be in the 50 each, so close to 50 cents. So it can give you a kind of idea about the growth.
Okay, that gives me something to work with. Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Scott Chan with Canaccord Genuity. Your line is
Good evening. I just wanted to go back to the 17 cents and 38 cents. My initial reaction was that the 17 cents was like a half period earnings accretion. Based on the net neutrality, you stated in the first year after close in mid-2020. Is that right, or is what you talked about before more relevant to the trajectory difference that we see in both years?
Now, it's not exactly that, because you have to factor in that there's growth as well there, so it's not necessarily linear on the acquisition.
Okay. Just going back to the 10 to 12 times that you stated for these type of transactions, is that based on past transactions you see, or can you refer us to any, say, U.S. publicly traded companies that are in this extended vehicle warranty business?
We've looked at recent transactions, and those are the metrics that were being used. That's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Steve Theriault with Eight Capital. Your line is open.
Good evening, guys. I apologize. I jumped on late, but I had a couple follow-ups. I was going to ask about the integration costs, but I think you've covered that. On the EBITDA margin that was mentioned, is it that IAS has a much bigger skew towards sort of the ancillary warranty products and less towards sort of the plain vanilla extended warranty products that we often think of?
That is correct.
Okay. And when you look at the mix of these two entities put together, obviously that skews the mix much more towards ancillary. Like, is that preferable? And I guess, you know, as you mentioned, it's a big deal for you guys. But when you think to future deals, is it the ancillary business that's more attractive, or are you more likely to generally look at more well-rounded roll-ups, or are you now overweight ancillary and therefore future deals will be more sort of the plain vanilla extended warranty product?
I think what is important here is that we have the capability now to offer the full suite of products and to all the dealers we're dealing with. I think that's the way you should look at it. Like I said before, like DAC and IAS, they are doing business with, you know, between 4,000 and 5,000 dealers. They're not the same for the large portion of it. We have not factored in our EPS accretiveness the fact that, you know, there could be some cross-selling along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is that we have the capability now to offer because dealers, they sell all those products. And what happened is that for some dealers, they sell only the ancillary with us because, you know, IAS was more concentrated in those. And because, for example, for IAS, you know, the penetration on VSC is 16% of the dealers. So 16% of the dealers of IAS are using, let's say, the VSC. So there's a lot of potential for us to, I would say, cross-sell along the way. We have not factored in those cross-selling opportunities within our estimate.
Okay, so that was my follow-up. The 17 and 38 cents that you mentioned, that doesn't include any revenue synergies, including these ones?
It does not include synergy revenue for cross-selling, no.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a follow-up question from line of Darko Mihelic with RBC Capital Markets. Your line is opening.
Hi, thank you for taking my question, my follow-up questions. Just a couple here. One very simple one. I just want to make sure that, because I haven't seen this anywhere in your press materials, but is there any contingent consideration or future possible payments on this acquisition?
No.
Okay, perfect. And then second to that then, more to the point, you know, this is a large acquisition, and you mentioned that you really want to keep your eye on the ball. So what I would be interested in, I can't remember under DAC when you acquired them if there was some sort of risk of loss of business. Is there baked into your 17 cents and 30, is there a level of conservatism where you assume some dealer relationships leave or anything like that? Like, what would the risks be to this acquisition, and what have you baked into your numbers for those risks?
So the way I look at it, Darko, is that, like I said, the recent past, the growth of IAS was around 16%. What we have factored in our projection is way lower than the 16%. So you have to look at it at high level like that.
Okay, so there's no risk that dealers just get up and go and their business walks away.
I don't see, a large number of dealers moving away. I mean, I don't see why they would do that.
Right. Okay. So the only thing is that you just assumed a much lower rate of growth than IAS's recent history. That's fair.
That is fair.
Okay. Great. Thanks very much.
And we have another follow-up from line of Tom McKinnon with BMO Capital Markets.
Yeah, thanks very much. On slide 9, you show the adjusted EBITDA in U.S. dollars for these companies, for DAC and IAS. Would you be prepared to tell us what the earnings would be associated with that EBITDA?
The core
earnings.
Yeah, well, in fact, no. I mean, in fact, what we are prepared to share with you today is really the accretiveness. I mean, we would rather stay at that level as opposed to dig into all the numbers of, you know, what's the revenue synergy, what's the expense synergy. I think with the accretiveness, we provided it for the first 3 years, you have a pretty good idea of, you know, what the net is.
Okay, and then the last one is in June 2018, when you had your investor day, Mike Stickney had said you'd be looking to spend U.S. $300 million over the next 2 to 3 years. This is more than twice this. You know, what drove you to go higher and bigger in this, and why?
Yeah, I like that question. In fact, Tom, over the last year, I mean, in the first year in my tenure, the executive team, we made a lot of reflection about where we want to go as a company. And one of the things that came out of this process was that in the lines of business we want to be in, we want to be a leader, meaning being top three right now or eventually be a top three. And we also, to some extent, wanted to be a bit bolder. So when you combine the two together and we looked at the opportunity in the U.S., we thought that this was a great place to, not to start, but at least there were opportunities, more opportunities there than anywhere else. So it's more like the end result of a one-year reflection at the executive level.
Okay, thanks.
And we have another follow-up from Mario Mendonca, TD Securities.
This is not a question per se. I just want to make sure that I heard you correctly. Slide 9, I thought that was Canadian dollars. Is that U.S. or Canadian?
No, it's all U.S.
It's all U.S. Okay, good enough. Thank you.
And there are no further questions waiting at present time. Please continue with your presentation or closing remarks.
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks a lot. Listen, obviously, I know that you are very busy because it's the bank's earnings season, and obviously we needed to get out today because we signed the agreement. There's a lot of things that are in that deal or in this type of business, and obviously we'll take the time with you guys at the next Investor Day. We'll take the time to go over all the business and give you a lot more details. So during the next few months, we'll obviously work on finalizing the whole thing. And hopefully we can do that in the first quarter or at the beginning of second quarter. So we'll be ready for the Investor Day to provide you much, much more information, and then you'll be able to meet our management. So with that said, thank you very much, and I know that you have probably a lot of still some time to work tonight, so I'll leave you there. Thank you.
And that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation. Ask that you please disconnect your lines.